Case number 20-1187 et al. Beyond Nuclear, Inc. Petitioner versus U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and United States of America. Ms. Curran for the petitioner Beyond Nuclear, Mr. Taylor for the petitioners Don't Waste Michigan and the Sierra Club, Mr. Kanner for the petitioner Baskin, Mr. Averback for the federal respondents, Mr. Clements, amicus curiae for the Nuclear Energy Institute, Ms. Leidig for the respondent intervener Holtec.
Morning.
Good morning. My name is Diane Curran. I represent petitioner Beyond Nuclear. I'd like to save 2 minutes for rebuttal. This appeal presents a clear case of agency overreach that is redressable by a simple act by this court to sever unlawful language from Holtec's license application as approved by the NRC. At page 32 of its brief, the NRC says, quote, "The entire point of a licensing proceeding is to ensure that any license is consistent with applicable law," close quote. Instead of using its licensing proceeding to ensure that Holtec's operation would comply with the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, the NRC decided for itself how that law might change in the future and granted Holtec a permit to carry out that made-up law. The NRC, I'm sorry.
If the application had just said Holtec will be permitted to take title to whether Holtec will be able to store commercial reactor waste, instead of referring to privately owned or DOE owned. So I didn't say this very clearly. I think the application referred to DOE owned and privately owned waste.
Correct.
But what if it had just referred to commercial reactor waste?
That would have been consistent with the Atomic Energy Act.
Okay. And my understanding, and I understand this wasn't part of the record when the decision was made, so I take that point. But my understanding is the license itself does only refer to commercial reactor waste. It never once mentions DOE.
Well,
is that right?
Well, the NRC in the licensing decision approved the application with the intent that Holtec, their decision approved Holtec's ultimate ability to store federally owned spent fuel if the law changed.
But I guess my question is, shouldn't it matter that the license itself makes no reference to DOE-owned waste?
The NRC clearly stated that they intended not for the license activity includes what's also approved in the NRC's adjudicatory decision. It's not just what's in the four corners of the license, which is not part of the record of the case.
I understand that. You said earlier if the application had just referred to commercial reactor waste, and the application would have been okay.
Yes.
Well, and then we end up with a license that licenses exactly what you said would have been okay to apply for.
The license also says that the operation can operate, the licensee can operate in compliance with what was in its application. That is also in the license. And in the application are a number of provisions that contemplate storage of federally owned spent fuel.
I appreciate that. Is one of your concerns that the license or the application would permit Holtec to store foreign waste or non-commercial reactor waste, like from Navy ships? Or is that not something you're worried
about? We're concerned about the issue of there's quite a bit of spent fuel that could be stored at this facility. The NRC seems to be contemplating some event where the NRC would say, the government, the Congress would say, we're going to take title for all this commercial spent fuel, which is the Nuclear Waste Policy Act's intention ultimately when there's a repository. And they're jumping the gun, effectively saying.
What if the Department of Defense made a contract with the construction company to build a hangar for planes, and it said the hangar should be able to accommodate the B-21 or five smaller planes. And there's a statute that says the Department of Defense is not allowed to purchase B-21s. Do you think that the contract between the Department of Defense and the construction company would be contrary to law just because it refers to a hangar that can accommodate B-21s?
Well, a contract or a permit has to be enforceable on its terms. If this was the NRC, that's the PFS case, 52 NRC at 34, that's cited in our brief. And this is consistent with the Administrative Procedure Act. A contract or a license isn't supposed to have conditions that people can't understand now or figure out what it means.
Hypothetical contract, is that
a hypothetical? Sure? Yeah, a contract would, in this case, would be analogous to the permit, which is it gives Holtec some rights for what they can do.
Asking, in my hypothetical, do you think the contract is contrary to law? Is a contract?
It appears to be, yes.
Ms. Curry, let me ask you. So procedurally, Beyond Nuclear was denied the ability to intervene. And so you can't challenge the license itself. You can only challenge the denial of your request to intervene. Isn't that correct?
That's right. When we request a hearing, it has to be based on the application. We have to raise a dispute with the application. We were told you can't raise a dispute here because we all agree that this license application contains illegal provisions.
So there has to be, in order to intervene in the proceeding, you have to show that there's some genuine dispute about the law.
That's right.
And so what can you point to that suggests the law does not permit a conditional license here? So this is different from like the Don't Waste Michigan case. Why can't an agency or why can't the NRC in this specific context grant a license that has some conditions in the future? I mean, we've upheld conditional licenses in a number of other contexts. In Oglala Sioux case, there was a conditional license. We've upheld, which is in the same context, we've upheld conditional licenses issued by FERC. I mean, it's sort of an ordinary process. So what can you point to that suggests that it's contrary to law?
The PFS case is very helpful because that's a case where license conditions were in dispute. But the question there was, the NRC said license conditions are okay if they're precisely drawn and anybody who's in charge of administering the license can understand it without further analysis.
So what's not precise here? I
mean, what's not precise? Okay, let's just take a hypothetical.
I mean, if law changes, DOE could send their waste to Holtec's facility. Like, I don't see what's imprecise about that.
And that is certainly the kind of simplistic framework that the NRC sets up here. But let's take a hypothetical. Let's say Congress does change the law. We're 10 years down the road. Congress changes the law and says, we're going to take title to this spent fuel and we will pay. That's the issue. Who pays and how much? What if Congress puts a cap on the amount of money that it will spend? What if it's if they say we'll only pay on Wednesdays and not on Fridays?
The DOE will be bound by those legal provisions.
Well, yes, but we will never get a chance to have a hearing before the NRC on whether that's an adequate amount of money to safely store this quantity of spent fuel. We never got that hearing because nobody knew what the law was. And in the future, if after Holtec now has a license, if we go back and say we want a hearing, they say, it's too late. They've got the license. You can bring an enforcement petition and our decision will be essentially unreviewable under Heckler versus Cheney. We've lost the right to a hearing once Holtec gets a license. And there are potential safety issues. We just don't know what Congress might do in this law. Nobody knows.
My understanding from the briefing was that NRC says if and when new routes, for example, and new contracts arise, there will be new proceedings in which you can raise objections. Is that false?
I think that is a false implication. It's at page 32 of their brief. If you go back to the licensing board decision at page 465 of the joint appendix, they say the whole point of this is to avoid a hearing once after Congress changes the law, we can say the hearing already took place. A hearing at that point would be useless, not to us because we never got the hearing. There may have been a hearing on some issues where the law was clear. But on the very important issue of, is there enough money here? to safely store this waste. We were shut out from the beginning, and we will be shut out if the law changes.
Do you agree that the Bull Creek statement about the AEA authorizing this type of license is a holding that we're bound by?
We did not brief that issue. Our issue is under the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, a completely different statute. And we're concerned that, if the question of whether the Atomic Energy Act allows private storage is resolved, it still doesn't answer the question of whether the NRC can put a hypothetical license condition into a license like this. It could still be that the NRC's authorization of HOLTEC to store federally owned spent fuel remains, because they're just speculating. This is a license about what if Congress does something future in the future. It's not about what the law says now.
What about the fact, though, that DOE does own some of this fuel? So the license is at least valid as to, the fuel that, the spent fuel that DOE already owns and that could be stored. I understand that there's a small amount of that.
Yes, there's a small amount of that. It's minuscule in relation to the immense quantity of commercially generated spent fuel, which is at issue.
Makes the provision non-conditional as to that small amount, at least.
But clearly, the decision was, if you read the commission's decision, the licensing board's decision, they were anticipating government storage, a government assumption of ownership of commercially generated spent fuel. There is no doubt in that decision.
Just one other question that I had was, your proposed remedy is that this court sever part of the license?
Yes.
Can you point to where we have the authority to do that?
It's in the doctrine of severability, which...
With respect to a license?
It has been applied in a regulatory context, but the important point is that unlawful language cannot remain in the license. Whether the court decides to throw out the whole thing or to say we are rejecting this language, and we specifically identify the unlawful language in our brief, that language could be stricken. And we did move the NRC to dismiss the entire application or the unlawful language early on in the proceeding, and they refused. This would be going back and granting the relief we asked for, which is resubmit this application and leave out the unlawful language. That could be, we would not object to that.
I think Judge Walker asked you about this earlier, but where in the license is the unlawful language?
In the license, it's in the provision that says this company is allowed to operate in compliance with its license application. I think it's called the final safety analysis report.
I think I have the license in front of me, though could be wrong. Can you tell me more about where to look?
It's near the top. I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me. It's in one of the clauses. It's a very early clause. It's boilerplate language. That the NRC, the application is basically forms the basis for the license. The license itself is kind of a summary document that authorizes the licensee to do what they say they're going to do in their application. That's how NRC issues licenses.
Any questions?
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, I'm Wally Taylor. I represent several petitioners who sought to intervene in this proceeding and submitted several contentions. All of those contentions were denied. Because the NRC violated its own contention admissibility standard. The commission has repeatedly with their agency decisions said basically that all the petitioner has to do to present an admissible contention is to just raise factual issues and not just conclusory statements or vague allegations. And we did that with detailed factual statements, citing to the Holtec documents, and presenting expert testimony.
Mr. Taylor, it has to be, under the NRC's rules, it has to be information that was previously unavailable. So can you speak to how the information, you know, FASCN presented was previously unavailable?
I'm not sure that that's the standard for the initial contentions. That's something that would be necessary to amend the contention, or
isn't that part of the good cause requirement for a new contention?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that part of the good cause requirement for a new contention to be raised?
But we're not arguing new contentions. We're arguing our original contentions were not admitted because the NRC looked at the contentions in a manner that would be appropriate for determining the facts at a hearing, but not determining whether or not we had made the initial the presentation to just raise the factual issues. I would compare the admission.
I apologize. Can I ask a very basic question?
Sure.
Are you representing FASCN or the environmental petitioners?
Oh, sorry.
The environmental petitioners.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I'm sorry.
That,
no, I understand.
No, I'm sorry.
Can I direct
there's so many parties here. I'm sorry. That's the wrong term.
Yeah. So in your
I wonder where we were going with that.
Yeah, no. I'll ask FASCN that question.
Counsel, in your opening brief, you raised this argument about Bull Creek that we shouldn't look at to it, or it can be distinguished somehow. The commission says you did not raise that before the commission, and therefore that it was forfeited. And I think you didn't contest that in your reply brief. I'm just trying to figure out if you're conceding that that issue is not properly presented, or if you have some counter on that.
Well, the reason we put it in our initial brief was in anticipation that the NRC would say, well, even if the Nuclear Waste Policy Act doesn't give us the authority, the Atomic Energy Act does. So that's why we put it in our brief, and the NRC presented some extensive
response. That question is just whether there's any authority to license private away from reactor storage at all, right? And that is a distinct argument from the argument that Beyond Nuclear was raised.
Sure.
And it's
sure.
My understanding that that was not exhausted before
right.
The agency. You agree with that?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Can I ask you, you know, you have a lot of Sierra Club and Don't Waste Michigan have a lot of contentions. And what is, if you had to pick one, what is your strongest contention?
I think the strongest contention is, several contentions that involve the geology and groundwater, which we put, I think, in issue four in our brief. The contention regarding earthquakes, we relied on a recent, at that time at least, study by Stanford University that the oil and gas industry in doing their fracking had induced earthquakes, and that was at or near the Holtec site. And the NRC responded that, well, that new information, but they could have supplemented or revised their environmental report. In fact, they did that five times.
I thought that NRC considered the 2016 government data and the 2018 Stanford data and explained how the Stanford data was compatible with the government data.
Well, the Stanford data...
Did they do that, what I just said?
Yeah, the Stanford data was more recent, at least at that time, and certainly the more recent data, taking into account the increased fracking activity, made the earthquake potential greater. And as far as the groundwater, we had an expert who went through all of the Holtec documentation, pointed out exactly where he felt it was insufficient or incorrect.
My impression was that the expert gave really more of a list of questions, didn't really put any facts into contention.
Well, he did. I mean, to a certain extent, it was a form of questions, but there were facts because he pointed to references in the Holtec documentation where it was incorrect or misapplied. And the NRC's response was that, well, we hadn't really proven anything, but we don't have to prove anything at that point. That was my original point here that I made, is that we presented enough through expert opinion, references to the Holtec documentation, setting out the facts to lay a predicate for the admissibility of that contention. And then once it's admitted, then Holtec, and after discovery, Holtec can file what is in essence a motion for summary disposition, much like in a civil case. And in fact, I would compare the contention admissibility question to the review of a motion to dismiss regular civil litigation.
If you, on the groundwater expert witness, if you had to point to one material fact that the expert into dispute, or that is in dispute, that the expert asserted, what one material disputed fact would you?
What I can think off the top of my head is that he said there was only one a testing well in the area where it was most important, and Holtec said, "Well, we did four or five of them," but he, our expert, made clear that those four five others were not in a place where it was relevant. I think, do you have a question? Oh, my time is up. I'm sorry.
Yes, thank you.
Good morning. Alan Canner of Canner and Whiteley, on behalf of Fasken Land and Minerals and the Permian Basin Land and Royalty Owners. Collectively, I'll refer to them as Fasken. That's okay. And I'll reserve 3 minutes at the end. This is a case about competing land uses at a specific site in the Permian Basin. And NRC's decision to allow Fasken to make a record, decision not to allow Fasken to make a record that these were incompatible land uses. Instead, NRC threw out the rule book in favor of a garbage in, garbage out approach, which would lead it to its predetermined results. The Permian Basin, briefly.
Mr. Canner, if you could answer the question that I asked the other counsel is, what is the previously unavailable information that Fasken presented that would allow it to reopen the record or to show good cause for entering its contention?
So the 2020 affidavits of Stony Pollock and Tommy Taylor are probably the most useful. For example, Mr. Pollock talks about the karst formation, which is oil and gas available at about 1,200 feet. As you know, in the final EIS, a decision was made that it was unlikely that fracking would occur above 3,000 feet. That is different information. That is information that was disregarded by the NRC. He also talked about trends. If you're giving a license, you've got to look into the future a little bit. Fracking technology is evolving very rapidly.
I guess I don't understand how that is something that wouldn't have been available for him to testify to earlier.
Ah, good question. That's because Holtec lied and filed an incomplete application, inaccurate, incomplete, contrary to NRC rules. Specifically, They said that by agreements, they had control of the land. So in other words, what there's, when you say you have agreements with third parties, what you're telling Faskin, who doesn't know this is a lie, is that you've contacted all their mineral lessees, and you've also talked to the state regulatory authorities, the state land office, for example, because what they said is there will be no drilling below, above 5,000 feet. That's a lie. The final, we know it's a lie because the final EIS says that there is no control. The DEIS.
Just, regardless of what Holdeck said or didn't say, it seems like an assertion that fracking technology evolves is not something that was unknowable back when Faskin first had an opportunity to submit information.
But to what extent would it matter if they had total control of all activities there? I mean, what would the contention have been? Because we there was no one of the things that's, I said this was a lie, and I also said it was incomplete. They went through about 10 iterations of their application, and it was kind of a moving target through the whole thing. But if somebody says that we control by agreement all of this, then what's the materiality of the changing technology? Only when the land office said it was a lie.
Okay, fair enough.
We acted immediately.
A couple of different things. In your opening brief in the second footnote, you say that this appeal is moot after the Fifth Circuit's decision. This is similar to a question I asked one of the parties in the previous case, but I mean, if it's moot, then don't we lack jurisdiction to consider your petition?
Currently, it would be moot because the Fifth Circuit ruled on the merits in the ISP case. However, it's not a final decision. They've asked for a rehearing of the matter, but the NRC told the Fifth Circuit that the Holtec case was on all fours with the ISP case. And that was the sense in which I meant it was moot. It wasn't materially different. I mean,
has something changed? I mean, are you saying that the circuit's decision to go en banc has taken it from being moot to not moot?
It's not clear if they're going to take it or not. I'm trying to be honest and just say it's up in the air. I mean,
So it's your job to show jurisdiction. We don't have jurisdiction if your petition is moot, and you've said your petition is moot. So putting 2 + 2 = 4, it seems like you haven't shown jurisdiction.
I believe that jurisdiction has really not been disputed. If that was in some sense misleading, we did want the court to understand that there had been a ruling in the Fifth Circuit and that the NRC had said that the Holtec situation would be bound by whatever was decided in the ISP case. Okay. And if I should have used another word, I apologize.
No, I don't have to. I think I get it. You didn't. I get it. And then this is my last question. The NRC found that even if your contentions were true, they weren't material enough to justify reopening the record. And I'm sure you disagree with that. But where in your opening brief do you explain why that conclusion was wrong?
If I may explain it now, we talk about...
You start with where in your brief you said it, and then it's fine with me if you expand.
I'll get you that, if I could. I just want to... we talk about the final environmental impact statement in our brief. And in the final environmental impact statement, what they say is it's unlikely that anybody will mine potash, and it's likely that it will never be below 3,000 feet. That's why it's material. They basically admit it's material. And interestingly, they say that they're relying on new information, which is the same information that we tried to present to them. This is a highly unusual case because basically the contention we were making about there not being any control following the New Mexico Land Office ultimately, not in the DEIS, but in the final EIS, they said, oh yeah, that's right, there's no control, but it doesn't matter that there's no control. And then they make these statements like, well, it's unlikely for economic reasons that anybody's going to go after potash, when under the rules, they really have an obligation to look at what that means. And so in this case, I think that it's, you know, that we need a do-over, at least with respect to the very, the International Agency for Atomic Energy says that.
Before you go on too much, because I know you're running, it looks like you're low on time. I don't know if your co-counsel has found the page number or not. I'd like to know the page number of your opening brief where you say this.
Okay. Do you want me to stop and go look for it, or you want me to answer other questions while she's looking?
You can tell us on rebuttal.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm sorry I didn't have it on the top of my head.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Andrew Averbach from the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I appear on behalf of the federal respondents. I'm prepared to answer questions about the arguments that each of the petitioners have made, but I'd like to focus my time on the assertion that the agency lacks statutory authority under the Atomic Energy Act to issue licenses for the away from reactor storage of spent nuclear fuel. That argument fails for three independent reasons. First, the argument was not presented to the commission and therefore has been forfeited. Second, the argument is precluded by this court's holding in Bull Creek versus NRC. And third, the argument fails on the merits. The Atomic Energy Act confers authority on the commission by its plain language to issue licenses to private parties for the away from reactor storage of spent fuel. It confers authority on the agency to issue licenses both at reactors and away from reactors.
I'd be grateful if you could start there. What's the specific statutory provision that gives you the authority to do a license like this?
There are three separate provisions of the Atomic Energy Act, which authorize the commission to issue licenses for the constituent components of spent nuclear fuel, specifically 42 U.S.C. 2073, 42 U.S.C. 2093, and 42 U.S.C. 2111, covering source, byproduct.
The special nuclear waste and the byproduct, and there's one more.
Source.
And is your argument that each of them alone would authorize this license?
No, Your Honor. The argument is that the three acting in concert, because spent nuclear fuel contains each of those three core potential radioactive.
I guess I would understand how each of them individually would, because you know, if a spent fuel rod has special nuclear waste in it, and there's the authority to do a license for storing it, then there's authority to do a license for storing the fuel rod, regardless of what other products are in the fuel rod. And you could play that out with each of the three types. The argument that none of them is individually sufficient, but we sort of like do a penumbra emanation analysis of all three. And when we combine them into a cocktail, they give you the authority. I think that's a harder argument.
Well, to be clear, there's no spent fuel assembly that contains only one. So, and there's a prohibition against the possession without a license of any of the three materials. So in order to possess spent fuel, one need not be prohibited from doing so. One needs to have a license to possess special nuclear material and source material.
Each of the three requires a license, and each statutory provision gives Holtec, in this case, gives NRC authority to allow Holtec to store that thing. And
correct.
So in order to store a fuel rod with all three of those things, you basically need a license to store all three of those things.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That makes more sense.
And the license refers to each of those three types of materials. I wanted to at least begin my discussion of the AEA issue with this court's holding in Bull Creek. I know that there's been discussion both from the petitioners here as well as from the Fifth Circuit's decision suggesting that this court only assumed the existence of that authority in Bull Creek, but I would submit that's not correct, Your Honor. The Bull Creek decision was premised on the acknowledgement and the recognition of the NRC's authority under the AEA to issue licenses for away from reactor storage. And the reason I say that is because the court was construing 42 USC 10155H, which says, quoting, but generally, nothing in this chapter, i.e. the NWPA, shall be construed to authorize or encourage the private use of away from reactor storage or the federal use of away from reactor storage. But in order to reach the conclusion that provision had not completely eliminated the NRC's authority to issue storage license, the court specifically recognized that this authority existed not under this chapter, but under the AEA itself. So it had to carve out, it had to interpret that language in order to understand that there had not been a revocation as a consequence of the passage of the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, and then to conclude that passage of the Nuclear Waste Policy Act had left the agency's AEA authority, in this court's words, untouched.
And is that in part because implied repeals are disfavored?
Yes, Your Honor. The court certainly cited, Bull Creek Court cited to that precise principle. Let me turn also to the issue of the agency's actual authority, meaning the merits of the case. And as I mentioned, that authority is provided by three separate statutory provisions that I've referred to. Now, there has been argument in various briefs that we've received and that have been submitted to the court, suggesting that the fact that spent nuclear fuel is not referenced in any of those three statutes somehow means that the agency doesn't have authority to issue licenses of this type. But none of the material licenses that the agency, none of the authorities that pursuant to which the agency issues materials licenses, specifically name any kind of products or devices or items. Rather, Congress gave the agency the authority to issue licenses based or with reference to the core potentially radioactive materials that the licenses would cover. So in all kinds of licensing actions, such as for fuel fabrication facilities or uranium enrichment facilities or commercial irradiators, those products, those items, are not specifically named in the materials licensing provisions of the AEA. But nonetheless, the AEA, the NRC has been issuing licenses of this type for 75 years.
How common is it for an NRC license to have a condition like the type of condition here about DOE, you know, where some authority is granted in the future if there's a change in circumstance or a change in the law? Is that fairly common?
Well, there are conditions in many of its licenses. I'm a little perplexed by the question, though, only because the license itself doesn't actually refer to DOE. It's certainly the application that was submitted referred to nuclear power plant owners and or DOE, but that language is actually eliminated in the license. So
was it the NRC's position that if the law changed, OTEC couldn't take material from DOE?
If the law changed?
Like if Congress changed the law to allow that, is that not within the license?
Your Honor, if Congress were to change it and all other aspects of the fuel were covered by the license, such as that it satisfied the host of safety requirements that are incorporated into the license, then there would not be any particular prohibition against storing this DOE title, fuel to which DOE has acquired title. We're not at that point. Holtec has made a representation to the NRC that as long as that remains illegal, that it won't do it. And in the event that it tried to, there would be adequate remedies in order to prevent that from happening.
And is that true only for commercial reactor waste?
Well, the license, this particular license is for the storage of commercial waste. If Your Honor is referring to defense waste, I think that's beyond the scope of the license.
What would be those mechanisms? I mean, Ms. Curran said for Beyond Nuclear that there would be no way to challenge this in the future. Is that,
well, first of all,
the commission's view of that?
A couple points. First, the commission could take action as against its licensee in order to enforce the representations that were made to it during the licensing process. Second, I think that if the Department of Energy were to accept fuel that was deemed to be an illegal transfer of title, then there would be action as against the Department of Energy pursuant to either the APA or the Nuclear Waste Policy Act or potentially under the Hobbs Act. I mean, there are a variety of different vehicles that might be employed to do that. But certainly, the agency would hold the licensee responsible for violating representations it made during the course of the licensing proceeding. And those representations the NRC considers to be binding, much as if this court instructed me on, you know, on behalf of the NRC to notify the court or to not take...
And if the NRC took no enforcement action, is there any recourse to petitioners?
As against the NRC? Well, counsel mentioned what was what's referred to as a citizen petition or a petition pursuant to 10 CFR 2.206, which asks the agency to take action as against the licensee to suspend or modify or amend a license in the event of the of identification of some form of safety issue.
But declining to enforce would not be judicially reviewable.
Well, Your Honor, there are two separate questions about that. One, there's jurisdiction under this court's, under the Supreme Court's decision in Lorien. There is a presumption of unreviewability for prosecutorial discretion types that you're referencing in Heckler v. Cheney, but it's not an insurmountable task. I recognize that it takes a showing of an abdication of authority or something to that effect, but we have seen litigation challenging the commission's denials of 2206 petitions and we're forced to defend them on the merits. The only other point I'd like to make...
Can I just follow up on that issue? So at a sort of a first level, I understand your argument to be that this is a license to hold a particular type of waste. And this is what the commission says on page 465 of the appendix, is essentially it doesn't matter who the waste comes from. It matters that we've approved this site with these practices and... you know, at this location to store this type of waste. Is that, you know, is everything I've said so far correct?
Yes, and without overstating, yes, Your Honor, it is correct. Right. Without overstating or oversimplifying, the commission's focus is on the safety of the storage of the fuel. I don't want to minimize the issue that's been raising here by suggesting that's a paperwork issue, but fundamentally, the owner of the fuel is not a consideration that the agency needs to take into account in determining whether or not the storage of the fuel is safe.
Right. So the hypothetical I think they spun out, I'm not sure this was in their brief, but it was if Congress in the future allows DOE to store this type of fuel with a private company, and but imposes funding restrictions that might hypothetically mean Holtec can't get enough money to follow what it promised to do in the license, that would raise a practical concern. And it seems to me that would raise a practical concern if there was no way for them or the commission to challenge and enforce the license against Holtec. It seems to me like your answer is the commission would enforce.
Recognizing that it's not, certainly the commission would, well, I didn't quite catch the last part.
Your position is if they didn't have enough money, DOE funding to comply with the license, then they would just be violating the license and the commission would take whatever
absolutely
has to enforce the license.
Absolutely. And I would note too that the commission's oversight over licensees is certainly informed by citizen petitions that might come in, but also by its ongoing enforcement of regulatory requirements. And on a yearly basis, the agency makes sure that there is adequate funding in place, for example, to support to provide for decommissioning in the event that decommissioning becomes necessary. So it's not as though the agency simply closes the book on its oversight of the financial arrangements of the facility. And were there to be a meaningful change in the conditions such that what had previously happened with respect to privately titled fuel might no longer be applicable, that would certainly provide an impetus for the agency to investigate further and to oversee ongoing activities.
But it's not
activities.
As extreme, the world in which their complaint would make even less sense would be if, you know, for any future contract Holtec reaches with a private company or with DOE, that that contract itself needs to be approved by the commission? And my understanding is that, that's not the way this will work in the future. Holtec, if it finds a customer, doesn't need to come back to the commission.
Well, the terms of the license are such that as issued,
it should sort of self-execute.
Right? Yes, but the agency does commit itself to oversight to make sure that these requirements, as you know, not only the health and safety aspects of its oversight, but also the financial elements of its oversight, are satisfied on a periodic basis. And to the extent they're not, then the agency would take appropriate action.
You could have said, for environmental effects, we've evaluated this fuel and it doesn't matter who owns it, private or DOE. But I think instead you said we've done the environmental evaluation for privately owned and for DOE owned. But there isn't much DOE owned. So I'm not sure what you meant by that.
I'm not sure
you're not sure what, sorry.
I'm not sure I said what.
Well, not you specifically, but I think amid JA465, the NRC staff assures us that the staff bases its safety and environmental reviews on the application as presented, which seeks a license on the basis that either DOE or private entities may hold title to the waste. So it seems like you're assuring us that you're reviewing the application in light of both possibilities. Maybe I'm wrong about that. And then if you are reviewing the environmental effects in light of both possibilities, the possibility that's legal now and the possibility that may one day become legal, I guess, how did you do the evaluation for the possibility that might one day become legal if at this time there isn't much DOE owned fuel to?
I don't believe that there are any distinct environmental effects of owning fuel to which the Department of Energy, as distinct from a commercial utility,
that was my guess. But yeah, it doesn't matter who owns it.
That's correct. From a health and safety perspective, no. From an environmental perspective, no. It doesn't make any difference. There's a different amount of paper. There are probably different forms involved. Okay. But I don't think that there's a distinct.
That's effect. What I thought it meant, and that's what I was hoping it meant. But I just wanted to make sure that's what it meant.
Your Honor, unless there are any further questions.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Paul Clement for the amicus NEI. I'm going to focus on the two issues that we focused on in our amicus brief. The first of that is this question about the status of Bull Creek and whether the Atomic Energy Act provides the authority for offsite storage. That issue is incredibly important to my clients, but as I understand where we are in the case right now, it's been forfeited twice over. And I thought I heard my friend from the Sierra Club basically say they're no longer taking issue with that, no longer even really raising it. So as much as my clients would love a full-throated re-endorsement of the holding, which was in fact a holding, unless the court has any questions, I mean, it just seems like there's not too much to say about that issue. So maybe then I'll turn to the second issue we addressed in the brief, which is the beyond nuclear argument that somehow the sort of disjunctive reference to the possibility of DOE taking title somehow makes this whole process unlawful. And let me start by just trying to underscore how absolutist and extremist that position is. Because what it really comes down to concretely is that in the proposed application, and this is on page 40 of the joint appendix, in the 17th condition on the proposed license, there is a parenthetical and disjunctive reference to the possibility that the spent nuclear fuel that's going to be stored in this facility is, you know, DOE or privately owned. And as Judge Walker alluded to, although it's outside the record, by the time you get to the actual, like, license, the parenthetical disappears. And, of course, you know, that makes sense because the parenthetical is actually not even particularly necessary to anything. It's like, you know, if you were thinking about like a pedestrian example, like licensing a bar, and it said that, you know, we'll have a capacity for 200 lawful patrons, and then it said 18 or 21. I mean, you know, and
maybe this is just pointless formality, but I think we're not reviewing the license. We're reviewing whether the contentions were properly rejected. The final license wasn't before the NRC when it rejected the contentions. So what's the argument for why we're allowed to kind of peek at the final license?
You can, it doesn't even matter whether you can peek at it, because I'm not sure you can as a technical matter. My point is that if the relief is to strike something that's actually superfluous, like, that just shows there's something wrong with the argument that's actually before you squarely. And so that's why I'm pointing to what is in the joint appendix, which is in the record, and it shows you that this is just it's a disjunctive parenthetical. And the reason it can be in a parenthetical is because it doesn't really matter for purposes of this whole licensing process who has title to the spent nuclear fuel. And maybe this will help kind of clarify.
But does that mean, I mean, it is a consequence of that argument that it could Holtec eventually, if it became lawful, take DOE titled waste?
Yes, it could, because under the proposed license, under the licensed as issue. And just to make clear, like,
and why would that be? I mean, because you're relying on the fact that it's not even in the final license.
No, but what's not in the final is the parenthetical. There's still this condition that you have to have a contract with somebody who has spent nuclear fuel. It just no longer specifies that that could be DOE in some future world, or it could be a private party right now. So the superfluous parenthetical has dropped out, which shows that it's superfluous. And the license is now written in a way that basically says anybody who lawfully owns the commercial spent nuclear fuel can contract with Holtec.
DOE at some future date lawfully owned such fuel, they could contract with Holtec.
Yes. And
the same way a private entity could.
Absolutely. And just to try to make this even more clear, as a practical matter, in theory, it could be some other spent nuclear fuel that DOE somehow takes title to under some change in the law. But what we're really talking about is the exact same spent nuclear fuel that is currently in, you know, on-site storage facilities, including at decommissioned sites. And as a technical matter, the reason that DOE can't take title to that right now is because the Nuclear Waste Policy Act said that they can't take title to that until the Yucca Mountain facility is operational. So we have this, you know, unusual situation now where, you know, the federal government is essentially paying for the storage of this spent nuclear fuel because of decisions that have said other provisions in the act mean that as of 1998, the federal government is basically on the hook for the storage costs, but they can't take title under the law as it currently stands. And all the license did here is quite sensibly observe that and say, you know, that's not the most like long-term stable solution in the world. And maybe at some point, Congress is going to revisit this and transfer title to the same nuclear, spent nuclear fuel back to DOE. And that's not going to make any difference as to, you know, as you alluded to, but that's why I think the provision in the joint appendix you were reading, you know, nothing turns on literally who has title to the waste, because it's the same darn waste at the end of the day. And so, you know, some of the arguments that you see, like in the licensing process, like if it's timely raised, I suppose the commission can consider the karst formulations under the storage facility, but the karst doesn't change if title shifts from a private party to the DOE. And so that's...
What's the best way to distinguish INRI Aiken? You know, they make the argument that, well, the NRC erred then when it said the law might change, so we're going to act as if the law might change. And here, the NRC is acting in a way that sort of assumes the law might change.
Yeah, and I think the difference in the end is in INRI Aiken made that assumption, and then they did something that is currently unlawful, unambiguously so. They wouldn't move forward even though they had the command to do it, and there were available appropriated funds. So with all due respect to my friend, I can understand why this court, you know, issued a mandamus there. But this situation is nothing like that. I mean, and this situation is very much like your hypothetical about the hangar, where it, you know, it's actually kind of sensible government to say, all right, we're building a facility. We want it to work now. But if in the near future, there's a possibility that there's going to be a bigger airplane authorized by Congress, it would really be imprudent to have a hangar that isn't big enough for this new this new plane.
Can you think of any other examples? You know, I also thought of like a building permit that you can't actually act on the permit until something's been rezoned. Do you have any examples that can help?
I don't know that I have any other sort of examples that help. What I would say is two things. One, I think this is the easy case because this isn't a situation where the only thing that the license is designed for is currently not authorized by law. I would say even in that case, there's not an APA problem with that kind of conditional license. But here, since it's in the disjunctive and there is a real world example where it's perfectly fine, then that seems to me to be the relatively easy case. That's why I think it's like, okay, I got a bar, I want a license, the drinking age is currently 21. I want to make sure that the license for the facility, which really doesn't turn on the age of the patrons, is still valid if they change the drinking age. So I got a provision in there that says that there's no separation of powers problem there. There's nothing remotely problematic.
In your view, this isn't even a conditional license. This is a license that says you can do this and, you know, some other activities may come into what the license approves in the future.
This is a conditional license with a reference in the disjunctive, in a parenthetical, to the possibility that the law could change and Holtec would end up contracting with DOE rather than the private parties that currently have title to the spent nuclear fuel. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Ann Leidick from Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman, representing intervener Holtec International. I'd like to very briefly address some of the Faskin contentions, specifically Faskin contention, amended contention 2 and contention 3. Once those came into this proceeding, they should not have challenged the Holtec environmental report. What they needed to challenge was the staff's draft environmental impact statement because that was the active licensing document at that stage of the proceeding. The draft environmental impact statement does have a drilling depth of 3,000 feet, does recognize that New Mexico holds title to the land, and a variety of other things that Faskin has not challenged. But at that point, when Faskin came in and attempted to demonstrate a dispute with the application, they needed to demonstrate a dispute with the draft environmental impact statement. Of course, they also needed to demonstrate that they met the motion to reopen requirements, and we don't believe that they've met those here. The reopening requirements are, it's a very high bar to reopen an NRC proceeding after it has closed. And this court has upheld those requirements before in Duke Mason v. NRC, which is referenced in the Blue Ridge environmental case. And that actually provides a factual basis or a factual scenario where reopening the record once did happen. And you can tell when you read the case that it is a very, very, very high bar. We don't believe Faskin ever met that bar here. In fact, I don't believe that they ever really attempted to meet that bar here. And as a result, that's one of the many reasons why these contentions were not admitted by the licensing board or the commission.
The environmental petitioner said they think their strongest contention is the earthquake and groundwater contentions. Did they say anything today that you'd like to respond to?
No, I believe that the judges have read it correctly. The earthquake contention was rejected because the Stanford report did not actually dispute the content of the application. If you go and look at the application on pages 407 to 408 of the joint appendix, you'll see a description of fracking and the impact on earthquakes in the region. It specifies actually where the earthquakes are happening. It specifies the location of the faults in the area. And all of that is consistent with the information that was in the Stanford report. So while environmental petitioners had an expert report, that expert report did not demonstrate a genuine dispute with the application as it was required to do. In terms of the groundwater contentions, an overarching theme in the groundwater contentions is that the expert report did not address relevant information in the application. Again, this is required to establish a genuine dispute under the NRC's rules. That there needs to be a challenge to all of the relevant information to demonstrate that there even is a contention that is worth having a hearing on. If the expert fly specs takes one sentence here, one sentence there, and says, I dispute the sentence, you only had one well. Well, there were four wells. There were four wells. They were monitored for groundwater as the wells were drilled. There was a quality assurance program that was applied. A variety of other reasons to believe that all of those wells demonstrated that there was no groundwater in those locations. And the expert has to address that information when they come in. Otherwise, there's no way of the commission knowing if there is a real dispute here, which is why these contentions were rejected.
Before you're out of time, just to be extremely, almost unnecessarily clear, if Congress does not change the law to allow DOE-owned waste to be stored here, you do not plan to store DOE-owned waste?
Holtec will not store any waste that DOE has taken title to illegally under the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. That's correct. For those reasons, we request the petition to be denied.
Thank you. Ms. Curran, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Judge Walker, I'd like to give you the paragraph number for the license. It's paragraph 9. It says the license authorizes Holtec to operate as described in the final safety analysis report, which is the language used to describe the application. If you look at footnote 3 of our opening brief, it lists the language in the provisions of the FSAR that are unlawful. It was said that this is the same darn waste at the end of the day. It doesn't matter who owns it. And we don't think that's true because so much is about money. This is expensive material to care for safely. You know, safety is paramount, and it's often an issue. Who's going to pay for how long and how much? We don't know what the Congress may do if the law changes with respect to those issues. We want our right to be heard, and that can only happen if Holtec is forced to wait to apply for a license or a license amendment. Because, you know, we could
that
have
same
a license
argument
now.
Would apply to any contract with a private reactor, right? Everything you just said, you won't get another chance to talk about who's paying for how much. And instead, the recourse will be to make sure that Holtec is following the provisions of the license, right?
Right, but the devil is in the details in the license conditions, which we would want to, say in the PFS, the private fuel storage decision, once we knew what was Congress going to provide for in terms of funding, then we could ask for license conditions to make sure that the commitments were adequate to cover a very large quantity of spent fuel to be stored for a very long time. That takes place in the licensing provision proceeding. Once the license is issued, I think Mr. Averbach made it pretty clear, we have no rights anymore. The NRC is on its own to decide whether and to what extent to enforce the license. And in just one more comment about the Aiken case. That was a case in which the NRC was described as defiant. And we think that that applies here too, because right at the outset of this proceeding, we asked the NRC to send this license application back, ask Holtec to take out the unlawful language, and, you know, have an application that is the traditional private ownership of spent fuel. But the NRC refused and continue. Thank you very much.
Until that very last argument on the other side, I hadn't heard anything in response to our argument that the condition of disability standards were violated. So I thought maybe I was going to get by without having to respond to that. But Ms. Lundy, I think, made a statement that really explains what we're dealing with. She said our groundwater expert should have requested information. At the contention admissibility stage, we go by what the applicant, in this case Holtec, has put in their application documents. Discovery occurs after a contention is admitted. And that's why we feel that the agency violated its own contention admissibility standards. Since Mr. Averbach spent his argument about the Atomic Energy Act I'd ask permission to just make some brief comments in response. The Fifth Circuit in Texas versus NRC went through all of that and explained in detail why the Atomic Energy Act does not give the agency the authority to license.
The circuit, that's the Fifth Circuit, right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Judge Walker. So we talk about it in a number of places in our brief. The statement of issues presented obviously deals with reasonably anticipated future extraction operations and selection of Holtec. In addition, on page 16 through 17, we talk about the information was material to the required findings needed to satisfy the NRC siting. I will say that because of the word limitations, we reference other materials like our contentions, where we talk about it in greater detail and where the affidavits appear that I cited from earlier. But most important, and this goes also to the comment about materiality, the NRC staff agreed that contention two would be admissible in part to the extent that Faskin challenges the application's description of Holtec's control of mineral rights, including oil and gas extraction underneath the site. It has proffered an admissible contention, specifically by identifying what it asserts are material inconsistencies and potential inaccurate statements in the application that directly bear on the analyses. And it also goes on to say Faskin has provided the necessary threshold support for its dispute with Holtec's purported ability to control and limit future oil drilling and mining beneath the site. What happened was we were held to an elevated standard of good cause, and we believe we showed it. What the agency said was, oh, no, this was all previously available. But that doesn't make any sense, that it was all previously available. A, why did the state land office decide to send this out and say, your allegations are just wrong? How would we have known anybody lies? You don't walk into these applications and assume somebody is lying about controlling all of the minerals. And frankly,
colleagues have no further questions.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Case is submitted.